Accession number 17583, Reel 4.
Major Day, Reel 4.
Right, well, after Yan and Yang, the Chinese, as I explained, got us out of, or crossed Pinchang, and we fell back to Mandalay, and after Mandalay, the main body of the Chinese troops headed up to Maymu and back across the China border, North Burma border into China, whilst the balance of the troops, and I cannot tell you in numbers anything about them really, under Stilwell, came up the other way, heading towards Michinar in North Burma. In other words, west of the, not then west of the Irrawaddy, but up the Irrawaddy towards the north. I was suffering pretty badly from the earlier injury way down on the Bilin River by then, and I didn't actually have a break, but I was hospitalized into Maymu, which is a lovely hill station, only to find that Mandalay was about to fall, and the only way out of Maymu then would have been into China or back, well, into China or down to Mandalay. If Mandalay had gone, we wouldn't have got out. So it was decided, Mike Culvert was there then, and he was forming up the more lightly wounded officers and other ranks into what was his first commando.
Did you see Matt Calvert then?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Under what circumstances?
Well, he was knocking around, and he was coming around the hospitals finding out who was fit enough to go along with him. And also Mandalay was the military detention centre, so there was a military prison up there, and I seem to remember that anybody let out from there was put into his commando. I actually went back down again. I wasn't too bad by then. I went back down again and rejoined, found my way back to the battalion. We then fell back slowly to the north. I start to get a bit short of names after that, because not long after Mandalay fell, I was in trouble again, and I was shipped back up to hospital in Michinar, which is the furthest northern point, almost northern town on that side of Burma. And I then eventually got myself out by a series of problems into the Hukong Valley and down back into North Assam. And that was the end of my Burma campaign, or the first Burma campaign.
What do you think the Gurkhas made of the Japanese? You're talking about Gurkha bravery, and you're talking about the Japanese fighting to the death. So what do you think the Gurkhas made of the Japanese?
They had no particular... they knew they fought, but they didn't like them. What did the Gurkha make of the Japanese? Well, the poor Gurkha was absolutely bewildered, because if you can take my own involvement, we go back to the Satung, we go back to the Bilin River, we put in that, as far as we were concerned, frightfully successful counterattack. We lambasted the Jap, we were on top of the world, and then the next thing we get involved, where we have to retire under most awful circumstances, and we get involved in the retreat back to wherever. We get involved, we have another fight, we lambaste the Jap again, but because he's then managed to get round behind us once more, put a roadblock across the line of communication, Again, we have to come out at rate of knots. And the Gurkha just simply did not understand this constant retreat. I mean, every time he met the Japanese, he beat him. In spite of that, we were having to retreat all the time. It's a desperate problem with morale. The Gurkha morale remained very high, but it was not sapping of morale, it was an increase of anger. Look, sir, what the heck are we doing? We've just clobbered these blighters, and now we're running away again. Well, let me emphasize that that retreat was never running away. It was a very hard-fought, fighting retreat right through to the finish. And when we eventually got back to Imphal, we were all scarecrows, we were all rag and bone, but we were still in, the Gurkha units were still in pretty good fettle, and they actually marched back into Imphal carrying their arms and ammunition, such as they got. They were standing up, they'd been in clothes they'd been in for months, and some of them torn away. And by then we had British troops who had dysentery so badly, unpleasant as it is, but dysentery so badly that even if they had any shorts left, they never wore them. But there we are.
I hope you don't think it's a bloodthirsty question, but you were talking about the Gurkhas using their kukris on the Bilin River when you first saw them actually using it in action. But do they use their kukris to chop heads off or chop hands off? Or where do they use
it? Well, I don't know. I mean, where it really does is this sort of thing I'm a little chary of discussing. I mean, that's the Gurkha's pigeon. But no, I should say basically they prefer the kukri to the fixed sword or fixed bayonet. We're rifle regiment, we fix swords, but fixed bayonet. They're very adept at using it. It's a terrifying weapon. They can cut a man, they hit a man right, they can cut him in half with it. And they, I would say that the standard blow they tend to use is to go in underneath and come down probably at an angle across the side of the neck or the upper part of the shoulder. But I think really that it's a bit in for a dig for me to talk about how Gurkhas use their kukris.
But
all I can tell you is that they use it with great effect. Certainly they do decapitate people, yes, if you want to, yeah.
From my point of view, it's a bit difficult because it's so difficult for me to interview the Gurkhas themselves, to ask them.
I see, yes. Well, you always get somebody, fortunately I am still bilingual, or trilingual, but I speak fluent Hindi too. Get somebody like myself to interpret for you. But I think what you've got to do then probably is to... No, you haven't, you've got Burma, yes. Anyway, one could translate for it, but no, it's a terrifying weapon. It's extremely well balanced, and used in the expert hands of the Gurkha, it's a devastating weapon.
So presumably they didn't train you how to use it?
Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think the Saab is expected to use a kukri. I have used a kukri once in anger.
Where was
and,
that?
Well, that was at Prome, actually, by a haystack. But somebody once said to me, I understand your Gurkhas, if they draw their kukri, they won't put it away without christening it with blood. Well, my response to that was, as far as I was concerned, I used the curve of my kukri to sharpen a pencil. But that, in fact, was what I was doing. I had it in my lap and I was sharpening a pencil by a haystack. And I got a pencil out of a school somewhere. I thought I might write messages or something very clever with it. And a Jap appeared and I had to hit him with a kukri because I had nothing else to hit him with. My orderly, who was with me, was so convulsed with... The Gurkha has a strange sense of humour. He was so convulsed with laughter that Sunar Gurung, my orderly, who should have dispatched the chap quickly, He failed to do so, but there we are.
Was he convulsed because of your... But was the Japanese killed?
I made a mess of him, soon I killed him, yeah.
How did he just suddenly appear then?
I really don't know, but you see, it's a strange war. It was a strange war in Burma. You were in thick jungle and you got slip parties behind you. I mean, we had the talk earlier on about this cavalry unit. Well, I have no doubt in my own mind that that village had been built and established long before the Japanese started the war. They'd been in there as a sleeping commando in deep jungle, and they'd probably linked up with one of the nasty Burmese independence units, and everybody kept quiet about them. Certainly on the Bilin River, in one case, one of those villages on our bank of the Bilin River had a concrete machine gun emplacement. Concrete, not stones or sandbag, a concrete machine gun emplacement. And I don't know, it may have been that the thing was built by the army in Burma for some strange reason, because it seemed to face the wrong way. But I don't know. I always came to the conclusion that it had been built there before the war started.
Now, you've reached India. Did you then have a long period of recuperation?
No, I had... I went back to Baclo, which was our regimental centre in the edge of Punch and Kashmir, really, on the end of the Kulu Kongra Valley. It's about 5,000 feet up. And in those days, you had a strange arrangement. Technically, that first Burma campaign, which was one of the roughest campaigns of the whole war, we were not technically on active service because Burma was part of the regular station of the Indian Army. Burma was run, really, from India. There was normally a Gurkha battalion stationed in northern Burma. So we were not on active service. Now, I'm not sure what this was leading up to. What was your question?
I was asking if you had a long period of recuperation in India.
Ah, yes. The problem was that, as it wasn't an active service area, when you'd been out of action for 28 days or whatever it was, you were, I think it was X-listed, which meant that you lost your acting rank. We took your pay down fairly sharply. I was an acting captain, probably a temporary captain, but never gazetted as such at that stage. I was an acting captain, so I would have been getting 640 rupees a month. Instead of the 400 rupees a month I was getting as second lieutenant. So that was bad enough. But the next thing that happened was that after you'd been out of action for 56 days, I think it was 56 days, you went on to furlough rates of pay, which was about two-thirds of your basic pay. So from 640 rupees a month down to two-thirds of 400, and about 300 rupees a month, was just not on. All right, I was on convalescent leave when I needed it, but I'd also met the most beautiful blonde and I needed more than 300 rupees a month. So the answer was that I was taken back on duty in the regimental centre, which I think gave me back my acting rank of captain and the pay. And by the kindness of the CO, I actually didn't do any work, but I had lots and lots of casual leave. So I used to go back to my hill station, used to do a couple of days duty in the centre, and then go back to my hill station, my beautiful blonde, for two or three days leave before I went back down again. But eventually, I got better, and I had command for a short time of a training company in the centre, and then in 43, I went back to the battalion in Imphal.
Just before we go on to that, 1942 is supposed to be the year of the so-called Quit India movement. Did you see anything?
Yes, I did. That there was a tremendous internal security problem which arose. I suppose about, I don't know whether it was August or a bit later, it was certainly the back end of 1942, and therefore I think that I did go back to the battalion earlier than the date that I have suggested, because travelling back from Buccleuch, which is in the Punjab, easy reference point would be Lahore, back to Imphal, which is via Calcutta, and then up the river to Dimapur, and then up the road from Dimapur to Imphal. It actually took me 11 days to do that journey, and that was largely, you're quite right, largely because the railway stations were burned out, and we'd had that. I think the uprising was the back end of August 1942. Yeah, and it was a very serious do. But it did not affect in any way, what you have to remember is it did not affect in any way the Indian Army. I mean, the Indian Army carried out their internal security duties and carried on as it always carried on.
Did you ever see any threatening crowds or anything of that kind?
Oh, yes, that happened, yes. But I don't know. Strange as it may seem, I never ever felt threatened in India, in riot and civil insurrection. I've always, as I did mention earlier, I've always spoken, I speak very fluent, I'm bilingual in Urdu, and I understand and speak pretty good Hindi. I'd probably get away in the dark without anybody knowing that I was British in those languages. And with the ability to speak the language, rightly or wrongly, I've never personally felt threatened. I mean, if I had to go into the bazaar when that sort of thing was going on, I would go and it wouldn't unduly worry me. I would certainly not go unless I had to. I mean, I wouldn't go looking for trouble, but no, I've never ever felt threatened in India.
It's interesting that you should say that in the midst of what people regard, what's regarded as a movement to get the British out of India.
Yeah. Well, I have to say it, and I would reiterate it, I definitely never felt threatened. And through that terrible period of partition in 1947, when the most ghastly things were happening, terrible things, again, we were fortunate in one caste regiment, but I never felt threatened except as a soldier might be threatened.
We'll come on to 1947 later.
No.
If we can go on from January 43, which I think is...
January 43. Well, I went back to the battalion, and after a while it was quite apparent that physically I couldn't keep up with things anymore. And I became, they had an administrative commandant's office in Imphal. I became staff captain Imphal. It was a very small organization with nebulous duties. We sort of tried to run the town itself. We tried to control the road supply line which came from Dimapur down on the Brahmaputra up through Kohima into the plain of Imphal. A lot of it was only single track working. The road had been hacked out of the hillsides by tens of thousands of tea garden labourers under the organisation of the tea planters themselves. And that supply line needed very careful massaging to keep it going. There was so much malaria and other sickness, not wounds, but sickness, in info that I do recollect on my daily sort of state of the play on that road, that at one stage we were shipping back, or had waiting to go back, more sick soldiers than we could get up as reinforcement. So we were an ever-decreasing quantity during that period, until somebody got hold of the idea of everybody taking prophylactic mepocrine, which worked like a charm. We all went bright yellow, but it did work, and it cut the fever down tremendously. Prior to that, we'd been on prophylactic quinine, which is not so effective, and it has most awful side effects. It causes an awful lot of deafness and singing in the ears. And also, quinine was in desperately short supply.
As staff captain, are you still with the 1st, 4th Gurkhas, or with some...
Technically, I was on loan from the 1st, 4th Gurkhas. My regiment remains 4th Gurkhas, but I would no longer be 1st Battalion. But in actual fact, I was, because I was up there, the battalion was there, and I was really on loan from them. And the strange thing that happened there is that I was in my office one day, office, which was a bamboo hut, if I remember rightly, and somebody came in, the commander of a sapper unit came in from a place called, in the front line, called Kangla Tongbe, and I heard him come in, and he came in, and I heard him sort of, I was on the signal telephone thing, and I heard him stop and salute, and then I heard a very rude word, and I looked up, and an extraordinary thing, it was my best friend from school, whom I hadn't seen since August 1939. And we're now beginning of 1943, and it's rather strange to meet somebody like that, the other side of the world, under rather desperate circumstances. Extraordinary coincidence.
So, coming back to the staff captain business, were you staff captain at some HQ?
Well, no, it was called the Admin Comms Office, the Administrative Commandant's Office, and it consisted, the staff in here consisted of the Admin Comm, who was Lieutenant Colonel from the Rata Regiment, myself as staff captain, and my assistant, who was a very young second lieutenant from the Dukes, actually, I think. We had a few clerks. We were able to supply money if the army wanted to buy supplies, because you couldn't get rations up, sufficient rations up, lots of the rations. At this stage, the war in Imphal was out from the town. The Imphal itself was not invested. It was leading a reasonably normal existence. We bought rations. We paid for rations. I personally controlled the flow of traffic up and down this road. Oh, we probably sighted hospitals, because we were getting tented hospitals in at the rate of knots. And in theory, we were supposed to know, on a sort of operational plan, where the units within the town were. I can't think why we were supposed to know, but I know that was a big part of the job.
Had you had any inkling at this stage of the impending Japanese attack on...
No, we were doing the other thing. We were driving further and further south down the Tidim Torbung tracks, and we were hoping, we did nothing about the Kohima attack, and even the first attack onto Imphal. We were pushing out, we were being quite successful. And then, from my point of view, they decided to raise two wartime Gurkha regiments, not battalions, the 25th and 26th Gurkha Rifles, and the 26th was being raised by a Colonel Dixon from the 1st Gurkhas. Have I got this right?
Looks like it from your script.
26 Gurkha rifles. They were being raised in Jhelum in the Punjab, and when you raise a battalion, well, the system was when you raised a battalion in those days, the CO was nominated to raise the battalion, and that was Arthur Dixon. He was then allowed to nominate his second-in-command and his adjutant. The rest of his officers were posted to him, and I was asked for as second-in-command, as far as I recollect. And so I left Imphal. I was by then Category C, physically. I left Imphal, and after the usual trials and tribulations of the journey back, I got back to Jhelum in the Punjab, where this regiment was being formed. And the most extraordinary thing was that in Jhelum, in the combined British military hospital, was a wartime nurse who was the beautiful blonde I told you I had met during my convalescent leave. She was the daughter of the number one of the old British India Corporation. She ceased to be a nurse about 3 months later, and we were married, and I brought her back as my bride, as a second-in-command, very proud second-in-command of the 26th Gurkha Rifles. We had a very checkered history, that regiment, because whilst we never got to war, we were, because the atomic bomb fell, we were spread out all over the place. I had two companies up in Attock Fort on the frontier. A company, what must be 200 miles south in headquarters, and one company in Jhelum. A record section down the Alilal Valley, sort of lower Punjab. And I had two companies in a rather weird Jules Verne type base that was built under hills north of Jhelum called Kala Base, which had been built as a sort of underground ordnance base, and railway trains could disappear into the mountains, when the whole of the defence in that part of the world was against possible Russian attack, which was the, always had been the enemy up there. And we soldiered on very happily through that period, until the bomb was dropped. And at that, then eventually, orders came to disband the battalion, the wartime raised battalion. And then the problem started. One could understand all the rules and regulations, but you depended on having a regimental centre or a base to disband in. You can't just start disband somewhere. You've got to have a bundle, you've got to have arrangements behind you. And I had no base, but the CO of the 6th Gurkhas,